You are Speaker Bob L. from Corona.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bob Lemke. I'm an alcoholic. It's always a pleasure to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's a little more meaningful when we have some new people or comparatively new people. As whether you new people realize this or not, and I'm sure you don't because we didn't, fact of life. Next to us old timers, you're the second most important people in the room tonight. Don't ever forget it. But really, without newcomers, this thing will probably end up with all us old timers standing around here telling these same old stories. We probably all get drunk. I'm what the book says is a real alcoholic. In fact, I'm one of those bar drinking drunks. Are there any bar drinkers here tonight? Thank God. I mean, I don't know where the rest of you did your thing, but I'll tell you what, if you didn't get some bar time in, you missed a lot of fun. I loved everything about those joints. I love everything that goes on in there. I like the smell in there. I like them stools you can spin around on. I like the mirrors they got in those places. You can dream all you want, you know. And I love them jukeboxes they got there, you know, the ones that play Born to Lose all day. You know? And you can cry and drink at the same time. You know, it's just wonderful. I guess I better tell you what, from the start what all happened. I was born in a little town in Wisconsin. And the day I was born, my dad was assistant chief of police in that town. And he was about 6'4", weighed 240 pounds, wore a uniform, carried a gun, scared the living bejesus out of you. And for the first 15 years of my life, I did everything that turkey told me to do, just out of fear. Because I knew deep down inside, if he ever hit me, he'd kill me. And he's a big moose and a tough cop, and I'm scared to death. And I did everything he told me to do. If he told me to run to the store, I literally ran to the store. I didn't slow down out of sight or nothing, and I run all the way back. If he told me to rake the leaves, I even raked the neighbor's leaves. And in Wisconsin, we have a lot of snow. And he taught me early in life, if 5 flakes of snow fell on our sidewalk, it's my job to get it off of there. And I did that religiously until this thing that happens to everybody in this room. About the age of 15, something happens to human beings. All of a sudden, the next day, mothers don't know nothing, parents don't know nothing, teachers are a bunch of, you know. The only one that knows anything is you. And it happened to me. I don't know if it happened to you, but it's very common at age 15. My kids turned over like that. At 15, all of a sudden, they're the smartest people walking the face of the earth. And that's the way it was with me. And I can remember this like it happened yesterday. I got up that morning, went downstairs, had breakfast, headed off to school. No big deal. Come home from school at noon for lunch. And it's snowing. I know my job, right? But this thing happened. This. All of a sudden, shoveling snow was demeaning. Yeah, you know, it take away all your character. Just out there shoveling snow like some hired person you should have doing that, you know. And I just said right that day, I said, I just won't do it no more. I don't care what he does to me. I just won't do it no more. Took the shovel, set it up against the house, went in, sat down at the kitchen table, started to eat my lunch. Then I heard the squad car pull up in front. Then I heard the car door slam. Then I heard the shovel out there on the sidewalk. And I said to myself, it's about time he does something around here. And he came in the house all out of breath because he wasn't used to manual labor. I'm doing it all. Came in the kitchen, went in the dining room, took off his cap and that big heavy Mackinaw they wear in the winter and that 45, laid it on the dining room table like he did every day. Came in the kitchen, sat down at the kitchen table right across from me. And he really threw a curve at me. He didn't say a word. And I'm starting to think already, you know. And I've been saving it up, you know, for 15 years. And I made up my mind, today is the day I'm going to lay it on him. And all of a sudden, I realized it's time to get back to school. So I got up and walked around the kitchen table, had to go past him, or supposed to go past him, and then into the dining room, out the front door, just back to school. I stopped right in front of him and reached down inside, got one of them pearls of wisdom I'd just been endowed with, right, you know? Looked him right in the eye, said the smartest thing I could think of. I said, "Is the snow heavy today?" Big mistake. He didn't say a word again. He just kind of turned in the chair like this. It came all the way from right field, direct hit. And I took off in the air, up against the dining room windows. And when I came to, I said to myself, and only to myself, "Nobody can hit me like that and get away. I'll get even with him, by God, if it kills me. I'll get even with him." And every day after that, every night, I'd sit there and plan his demise in the bedroom all by myself. And I understand today that's not proper thinking for a 15-year-old to be planning his father's demise. And a lot of things happened in my early years. And one of those winters, I can remember it like it was yesterday. Come home from school one day with three of my buddies, and we're walking down the street, get to the corner to go down to my house. And there across the street, passed out in a snowbank in full uniform, is my dad, dead drunk. And these three guys started teasing me about my drunk dad, a drunk cop. And we went to Fist City, and I won. But I'll never forget the feelings and emotions I had that day. I realized then and there that he disgraced that uniform he wore, disgraced that badge he wore, and lost the faith and trust of that community that he had pledged his life to protect and to serve. Big deal. About a year after that, another big deal happened. He died, 47 years old, from chronic alcoholism. The thing on his death certificate said heart attack, and I found out another fact of life that doctors lie on death certificates for certain people in certain towns, and they're still doing it today. Fact of life. About a year after that, another thing happened. I was going with this girl in high school. And right out of high school, it was a beautiful event. We got married, a beautiful event, crossed white shotguns, everything. She didn't like me to say that, you know, and I clean it up once in a while and say it happens in the best regulated families, right? And right away, we had a little girl, and I wasn't at the hospital that night because I had been hauling mail and doing garbage and groceries and all kinds of crap, cheap jobs, and it just wasn't enough to keep a family going. And I went down to see my dad's buddy, the chief, and I told the chief, "You know, I just can't make it on this kind of money." He said, "Go up to the sheriff's department tomorrow. I think they need help." Walked in the sheriff's department. I think it was all hooked up. Walked in the sheriff's department. They pinned a gold badge on me. And I got to be a drunk cop, just like my dad. And time doesn't permit me to tell you what can happen to a drunk cop, except stir up some old resentments, and God knows you don't need any more, especially when it comes to cops. Bunch of cop haters here today. Yeah. I can spot them a mile away. Guy sitting in the front row, three in the back, two over there, one right here. Cop haters. I can spot them. And my career in law enforcement was kind of brief, about 8.5 years. And one time, a bunch of cops and their wives were going to have a party. And I don't know about you, but most times at cops' party, the booze is all free. And so we headed out at the lake and at this big roadhouse, and cops and their wives. And my wife is wandering around looking for me. She couldn't find me. And finally, she went in the kitchen where the booze is, and sure enough, that's where I was. And she came sneaking up to me, and she whispered in my ear, "We're leaving." I said, "What are you talking about, woman? We just got here." She says, a little louder, "We're leaving." And she had the keys, and to this day, I don't know how she got the keys. And we left. And all the way home, she started bad-mouthing me again about my drinking. I mean, she started to say things like truth things that I don't like to hear. And she said things like how my drinking was affecting our entire life, she said. I said, now what are you talking about? She says, first of all, it's affecting our home life, our family life, our kids' lives, our financial life, our sex life. Everything about us is being affected by my drinking. I thought she's flipped her lid or something. And we got in the house and she wouldn't shut up. You Alanons understand that, you know. And I had it, you know. I reached for the 38. I said, listen, woman, listen to all I'm ever going to hear about you about my drinking. I'll blow your damn heads off. And she took off like a deer out the front door of that house, 6 blocks down the street, to the only place she knew she could get help, right? The sheriff's department that I work at. And I'd have got her to if she just slowed down. She was really moving. And it came out of that blackout, standing in the middle of the squad room at 3 o'clock in the morning with a 38 in my hand, going to kill somebody. And all the guys are standing around the squad room talking about all the crap that happened last night. And here I come. And they start looking at you like how your family looks at you. Know how your family looks at you? Kind of that look. And they're all giving me that look. And then my boss, the elected sheriff of the county, him and I are thick like this, you know? And he comes busting into the squad room. And he looked at those guys coming off the late shift. And then he started walking over towards me. And I just knew deep down in my heart what's going to happen. He's going to put his arm around me and tell all those guys, this is the best deputy I got. And he did a little turn on me. He walked towards me and then he turned his hand like this and says, Bob, hand it over, the badge and the gun. And he took away that badge, the gun, and the uniform, and I had to go out there and face that world bare naked. That's too much for a normal person, much less a drunk like me. So at the age of 31, I did the most adult, mature thing I could think of. I ran away from home. If there's any runners here today, I want to talk to you outside after the meeting. I don't know how it was with you, but I had read in a paper about a job in Los Angeles, and I called him, and I gave him some of my credentials, and the guy on the phone says, oh, you sound like just the guy we're looking for. And he says, I'll send you some travel money. That lit up my eyes a little bit. He's going to send me some travel money and a ticket to fly to Los Angeles. Wonderful. And I got on the plane, and I had this travel money that they gave me in advance. And when I got out of the plane, I had to stop at the airport bar and a couple of places along the way to find this office on Saturday, and walked in the office little drunk. But this guy that owned the company, he was from England, and old, and he didn't recognize it, I don't think. Anyway, he hired me, just like that. And I said, what about my wife and the kids and all the furniture? He says, don't worry about it, we'll take care of it. Oh my, that's a piece of change, boy. And so, wouldn't you know, I got a job in Los Angeles and in an appraisal company, in a real estate appraisal. And it worked out pretty good until one time we had another party. And I didn't do too well at that party. And my supervisor was an ex-cop. And things had happened. Like, I passed some bad checks. I was at this bar. It's called a Friendly Bar in Burbank. And that bartender, he said the damnedest thing to me. I said, I need some money, but I'd forgotten my checkbook. He says, Bob, it's all right. You can write a check on anything, piece of paper, toilet paper, anything. You can write it. I said, you can? He says, yeah, you can do that. I wrote it on the Olive National Bank. There is no such a bank. And about 2 days later, the Burbank Police Department got a hold of my boss, the ex-cop. And we're going to meet in the parking lot at the Starlight Bowl up in Burbank. And I'm sitting in the car with my boss and my wife, and we get to talking about all these happenings. And all of a sudden, he said, "You see that car sitting over in the back of the parking lot?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "That's Burbank cop. He's got a warrant for your arrest." I said, "Oh, Jesus." So he motioned that the cop come over, and he crawled in the car with me and my wife and my boss. He sat in the back seat and told that he had several checks in bars that all bounced. And he says, "What we're going to do is you come to the Burbank Police Department every Friday and pay off one of these checks, and we're not going to throw you in jail today." So I said, "Okay." And you know, I think it was 8 to 10 weeks, and I paid them all. And when I had it all done, I went and got drunk. I was celebrating. Free man again. God got it made. Just wouldn't stop. And we moved to Glendale. And I conned this guy out of renting his house to me. And they had a swimming pool and everything, you know. And the kids really just ate it up. And then I invited my friends from Wisconsin to come too. You know, I got to show them all the big place we got, a pool and everything, you know. Like I'm doing good and not doing good. And they all came. And I had to go down to the railroad station and pick them up and bring them over there. Oh, Jesus, it was a hell of a thing. And then I got to tell you about my last drunk. Last drunk started on December 27th, 1963. Another big deal, you know. Always big deals. And that night I finished eating dinner, and about 7:30 I said, "I'm going over and meet my buddies, and I'll be back in 2 hours. And she started, you know, yak, yak, yak. You know, Al-Anon's understand what's going on. And I said, "Listen, I just put in 40 for a bunch of ingrates around here, and I'm going to go see my friends, and I'll be back in 2 hours. Now knock it off." And like I said, it was the 27th of December, 1963, at about 7 in the evening. And I went to my favorite watering hole, a place called the Prelude on Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood, which really isn't a hell of a lot to shoot for. It was one of them padded sewers I frequent. You know, they didn't even have a front door, just curtains hanging there. You know? You've been in one, huh? And I really went there to meet these lifelong drinking buddies I met 2 weeks ago, you know. And here they all are. And we started doing the things real drunks do. They're doing them right now in Oxnard. You know, they're doing it right now in bars all over the city. Standing around talking in millions and spending in dimes. Trying to impress people we don't know with money we don't have. If you're a smart drunk like me, you're trying to put the make on them dollies down there at the end of the bar and impress the heck out of them. And you know where. And then I met this guy. His name was Pete. And Pete was really quite the guy. He was president of everything, you know. No matter what you talk about, he had the job. And this drunk wasn't going to end, and we had to leave that bar. And so we started living in abandoned cars, one of which was mine. You know how your car gets to be an abandoned car? It's kind of a legal thing. If you don't make the payments on the car for 6 times, it's automatically an abandoned car. And they're out looking for it, you know. And so we took over this car, and we started living and drinking. I mean, Pete could find a jug on election day in a dry state. I mean, he was really good. One of those great guys. He knew everything there is to know about everything. And so we stayed in there, and I don't know how long we were there. I did find out after a while, but at the time, I didn't know how long we were there. And one of those mornings, we all came to, and Pete didn't. And he had swallowed his tongue in an alcoholic convulsion in the middle of the night. And he was deader than a doornail. And I got fighting mad at everything and everybody, and God, if there is a God, because my great intellect and better judgment took over. I said, if there's a God, why would let a good guy like Pete go, who knows everything there is to know about everything, and let me stay? And it's the way it was. And when I realized how bad it was and that Pete was gone, a little voice went off in my head. I can remember it yet. And it said, Bob, you're next. And then I got scared. I've been through a lot of things in law enforcement, scary things, but this scared the living bejesus out of me. And I got out of that car and went home. And my wife was working at the studios in Burbank. And I got there at 10, and she got there at noon. And she came in the house, and she was a little ticked, you know. I can't say in public the things she called me, but I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. And then I told her about Pete, and she says, oh, isn't that funny? I said, it was not funny. She says, well, it was to me. I'm sitting at my desk at Warner Brothers, and you've been gone 18 days, and never a word from you. And I'd saved up some money, and I'm going to take the kids and go. And just about the time she made that decision, one of the vice presidents of Warner Brothers come walking through the secretary. Don't tell me there's no miracles. And he tapped her on the shoulder and said, you better do that in here. And he took her in his office, and for the first time in her life in the studio, she let it all hang out about this drunk she's married to and the father of her children. She saved up the money, and she's going to take the kids and go. And he said, why don't you have them try Alcoholics Anonymous? And she said, how do you know? He said, because I are one. And you know what? That was the first time in 37 years at the studios he broke his anonymity that morning to help one sick drunk, me. And I owed a debt of gratitude to Matt as long as I can remember. And he died. And I went to my first meeting that night, and it was it looked to me like a secret hall, you know, with long drapes and velvet and everything, you know, and all these gray-haired guys. And I whispered to her, and I said, you know, if I ever got that old, I'd quit too. She said, shut up. And so I just sat there, and some guy was up there, a speaker, and I walked out of my first AA meeting with sore ribs all night long. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? And I thought this was the only meeting in Glendale. And then one guy says to me, oh yeah, we've got other meetings in Glendale. He says, in fact, there's a club over on Central. He says, you might want to go in there. There's a lot of meetings there. I said, oh. My wife said, he'll be there. And so I got to the club in Glendale. It was up above a liquor store and a laundry. Now that's real planning, I'll tell you that. And I walked in that room, and they had those doors, those push bars like they have there. And I walked in the door, and two guys are sitting over here at a table playing cribbage. And I walk in the door, and they stop playing cribbage. And one of them poked the other one and said, we better do something with that one. Or he's going to start jackknife around the room here now. You know, I wasn't nervous, just quick, you know. And they applied the only therapy they knew at that time. They gave me a bucket of paint and a paintbrush, figuring that I could paint faster than anybody else in the place. And I painted that damn clubhouse, and I can't tell you to this day how long I painted. I don't know if I painted 5 days, 50 days, I don't know. But I'll never forget the day I finished. It was a bright Saturday morning. And you know, we're perfectionists, and we got to clean everything up just perfect, you know. And I cleaned everything up just perfect. And then I find out that one of those cribbage players had been a painter all his life. And just that fast, I'm ticked off. And I'm going to get drunk at every damn one of these people. And I headed for the back door. And I reached for the push bar in the back door of the clubhouse. And wouldn't you know it, The door came open, and there's some clown standing there with a big smile. He says, "Hi." And I said, "Shove it." He said, "Why do you say that to me? I don't even know you." I said, "Shove it anyhow." He said, "Come here, I want to talk to you." And he brought me in to meet and set me down on them Henroid chairs, you know, them cold metal ones. And he told me, just like that, he said, "You drinking every day? I'm your new sponsor. And you're going to go to a meeting every day. Do you understand that?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he was honest, you know. We went to a meeting every day until this point when I said to my wife, meetings every night? Tonight I'm not going. And wouldn't you know, that night he came early and picked me up, put me in the car, started down the freeway. I said, "Where are we going tonight?" He said, "We're going to the hole in the ground." I thought, "Oh my God, now they're going to bury me." For you, those of you who don't know where the hole in the ground is or was, it was underneath the E-Bell Club in Huntington Park, California, started by a guy by the name of Tex Adams, who'd been sober since Lincoln had the measles. Thank God for Pete, who started places like that for drunks like me, and he told me I had to study this book. He would not let up. And we're going to get out of the car and start down the steps of the E-Bell Club. And all of a sudden, something came through my head, and I said, "Joe, I got to ask you something." He says, "Yeah? What do you want now?" He was crusty. I says, "How long do I have to go to these damn meetings?" And just like that, his whole attitude changed, just like that. And he took his finger and shoved me into the corner at the bottom of the stairs in the stairwell. And he started to scream. And he took his finger and started to hit me in the chest. And he says, "You idiot." I didn't like that. He says, "You have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. Then you don't have to go to meetings anymore." Didn't make much sense then, but it sure does now. But that night, because he hit me in the chest and screamed at me, "I'll fix his clock. I might have to be in a meeting, but I'm not going to listen." Couple here tonight, huh? So he set you in the front row like a witness there, you know, so you don't nod off. And then some guy got up there and said, "If you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it," I thought, "What is this clown talking about? I mean, look this herd over," and I thought, "They're all losers. What am I doing here? A smart guy like me?" The meeting's going on, and all of a sudden I see this guy about three rows back, and he's scribbling on a piece of paper. I didn't know you had to take notes here. And I watch him like a clock. And all of a sudden he gets up and takes this piece of paper he'd been writing on, headed for the door during the meeting. Took the piece of paper, stuck it on a bulletin board, and split. I didn't know you can do that. And I'm an ex-cop. I think maybe that's some evidence. I better go and check it. And wouldn't you know, it was a little poem about drunks. And we'll get to that in a little bit at the end of this program here. But life went on. Life went on. And my wife, Joy and Alana, she sat in the meetings with me, in the AA meetings, and make sure I didn't run away or something like that. And then some nice old little lady came and tapped her on the shoulder at the AA meeting. She says, "I think you should come along with me." And she took him into the Al-Anon room, and she got to be a black belt Al-Anon. You know? Do you know what a black belt Al-Anon is? That's one that don't believe a word you say. She's on to everything you come up with. She's got an answer. And says, "Oh, yeah?" It's terrible. But she got to be a very active member of Al-Anon, and God love her. And on the 23rd of November 2001, she was diagnosed with melanoma cancer. And on the 23rd of December 2001, God came and took her from me, 3 weeks short of 54 years of marriage. And my life changed, man. My life changed. And I lived in that house for 7 years. And I went to talk at the old-timers meeting in Anaheim. And this guy comes over and he says, I want you to meet somebody. I said, is it a woman? And sure enough, it was a woman. And he brought Marilyn. And I'm an ex-cop. I got her number that fast. And I started calling Marilyn. And then we went to the movies. Then we went out to dinner and stuff like that. Even got to stay over a couple nights. On the 14th of June, 6 years ago, we got married, and we got a good thing going. She's a very active woman in Al-Anon. I mean, she's got, at our house in the morning, the phone starts ringing, and it's all her sponsees. They're all calling. I mean, sometimes she must have 100. The phone is ringing all the time. I have a lot of sponsees, but they don't call me very much. We meet them. But they're all sober. But how long is it? We have to talk about one other thing. It's about alcoholism, the family disease. First of all, are there any Texans here? No Texans. They move around. There's one. You know, the reason I ask that is when you talk in Texas, if in the first 5 minutes you don't tell them your sobriety date, they automatically assume you don't have one. And so in favor, in respect of that Alan, I mean that Texan out there, my sobriety date is the 13th of January, 1964, which means I just celebrated 51 years. Not bad for a drunk cop, huh? Anyway, where was I at? You know, I'm going to be 86 years old, and I know I look like 22, but but anyway, I got to tell you, it's about that time. This little poem I stole, it's called Which Place? Well, we'd better talk about that, about alcoholism, the family disease. Thanks a lot. The problem with alcoholism, if you don't believe it, that it's a family disease, do me a favor. Next week, whenever, go visit your neighborhood junior high school at high noon. Go in the lunchroom, stand back against the wall and watch the effects of alcoholism where you go, wherever you go. Wherever you go in this country, those kids are all sitting down at tables like that over there. And they're all having a bowl of soup and a sandwich and a cup of milk, and they're all talking. The girls are talking about the things they did with their mother last night. The boys are talking about the things they did with their father last night. But they're talking about things like what they're going to do together as a family and where they're going on vacation this year as a family and when they're going to go and visit grandma and grandpa as a family. But I don't care what junior high school you go to, there will always, always be a kid sitting over there, one down there, one over there, and they got their head down in their soup and they ain't saying nothing to nobody. Because you know what happened at their house? Like happened at my house and your house? About 3 in the morning, their drunken mother or their drunken father got them all out of a sound sleep, and the screaming and the hollering and all the profanity that goes on in alcoholic houses started all over again, calling their mother a damn whore and crap like that. And you know what? They never forget that. They might forgive you someday, but they never forget that. My daughter's birthday is today. She's 67 years old. Isn't that something? I can hardly believe it. But that's the way it is. And we have to do everything we can today when we go through the steps and work this program. We have to start thinking about this family disease. You know, today, with all the electronics we have in hospitals and everything today, they develop all kinds of status, you know? And they have status about alcoholism. And they say that the average alcoholic directly affects the lives of 15 more people. On the average, I affected a lot more than 15, I'll tell you that. But every alcoholic in this world affects about 15, directly affects the lives of 15 other people. Kids, wives, husbands, parents, grandparents, bosses, all kinds of stuff. And so we have to work on it. We really have to work on this thing. It's a big problem in our country. And so I am eternally grateful. It's about that time. I better share that poem with you, and then I'll sit down. It's a little poem entitled, Which Place? I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind. Started down that lonesome trail some of my friends to find. Came to a signboard on the trail, directions it did tell. Keep right to go to heaven, turn left to go to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless boozing rake. And knew there at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. So I started on the rocky path that leads to Satan's place, and shook within not knowing just what I'd have to face. Old Satan met me at the gate, what's your name, my friend? I said, I'm just old sober Sam that's come to a sad end. He glanced through some files, you made a mistake, I fear. You're listed as an alcoholic, we don't want you here. I said, I'm looking for my friends, and a smile stole over his face. If your friends are alcoholic, they're in the other place. So I went back the other way till the crossroads I did see and turned right to heaven as happy as could be. St. Peter smiled and said, come in. For you, I have a berth. You're an alcoholic. You've been through hell on earth. I saw old Dub and old Pete too. Bill C and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled because I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, I'll take warning. Learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell him you're going to heaven and he can go to hell. Thank you.
After that, you get to give our speaker another hand, because I follow directions today. I'd like to thank Judith for reading Chapter 3, Mike for reading Chapter 5, Judy for reading the 12 Traditions. All of the speaker meetings have or will be recorded this weekend. CDs will be available in the hospitality area for 7. $10 after each meeting. Thank you. And don't forget, there's the Alateen thing that's going to be going on in the Wainimi room at 7:30. Okay. And I've asked Kathy to read a vision for you and then lead us out in the Serenity Prayer.
Hi, my name's Kathy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kathy.
My sobriety date is September 18th, 1982. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. After a moment's meditation for the alcoholic who still suffers, will you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Keep coming back. It works if you work it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.